they willing to pay a little bit higher the price, but the quality is the most important.
Despite new tariffs, a Chinese trade delegation is confident Alaska seafood will sell. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 13th. Good evening, I'm Annie Feit. Also tonight, the Trump administration has put land into trust applications from tribes on hold for now.
There's a long time that goes into these applications, and it's definitely frustrating to see something potentially hold that up right at the end.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A delegation from China visited Kodiak Island this week with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, touring fish processing plants in Kodiak and Larsen Bay. Right in the middle of the visit, President Donald Trump's administration proposed more tariffs, which doesn't bode well for Alaska's seafood trade. But as Daisha Eaton with KMXT reports, that didn't dampen the delegation's enthusiasm for what Alaska has to offer.
The water is low today, so Alaska Department of Fish and Game employees in Kodiak are seining for sockeye salmon at the Buskin River Weir. Sport Fisheries Area Management biologist Tyler Polam says the Chinese delegation has come to learn about local fisheries management.
Sometimes when the water's low, we can't get them to go into the trap at the weir, so we thought we'd be better to just go ahead and beach seine for these fish. They're going to hang on to some of them. We'll go over there and we'll show them how we sample fish to get age, sex, and length information from them.
Mingzhen Zhang is among the delegation and says Kodiak is a stark contrast to her city.
Yeah, I'm from Beijing, so the best impression for me is less pollution.
China's northern capital city of more than 20,000 people is infamous for smog. Zhang says she works for one of China's largest media companies there.
I work for Tencent as a video producer, and we just try to understand how Alaska seafood works and try to make a video for it.
The group walks along a one-foot-wide wooden plank to the other side of the Buskin Weir, where a net is full and the ADF&G crew is already pulling fish out of the water. The Weir trip was just one of many outings for the delegation, which also toured Trident Seafoods, Ocean Beauty Seafoods, and Alaska Pacific Seafoods processing plants in Kodiak, as well as Icicle Seafoods in Larsen Bay. Most of the visitors work in the seafood industry in areas from purchasing to development and media. And right in the middle of their visit, President Donald Trump proposed more tariffs on Chinese goods, including seafood reprocessed in China and exported back to the United States. But that doesn't worry Wei Zhang. He works for SMH International in Shanghai, where he's also a representative for ASME. He says when he started working with ASME 20 years ago, most Chinese consumers couldn't find Alaska on a map. Now people ask for its seafood by name, and they can order a fillet online and have it delivered to their home within hours.
They're willing to pay a little bit higher the price, but the quality is the most important.
And he says Chinese consumers believe Alaska seafood is one of the healthiest products available because of the virtually pollution-free environment here and strict food safety rules.
They understand is Alaska seafood is means the high quality and food safety. This thing is more safe for them, not just for the feeding for the family, and it's good for feeding for the kids.
He says in a country where lack of environmental and workplace regulation means it isn't always easy to ensure food is pure, Alaskan seafood has an advantage. Xin Liu has been working in the seafood industry in China for more than 20 years, and she's impressed by Alaska's pristine waters and efficient food safety systems at processors. She says these are huge selling points.
I think right now safety is almost the number one point they focus on.
She's general manager for a seafood import-export company and CEO for Shanghai Halloween Frozen Food. She said she'd heard the news that new proposed tariffs had been announced by the Trump administration overnight, and it was troubling.
This, we really a little bit worried. But if you look for the long term, I think seafood is more and more popular in China.
Despite the continued tariffs, Liu says Alaska has something special that she believes will keep its products selling in China, at least to those who can afford them. China has a massive and growing middle class of consumers who have money to spend and want sustainable and wild seafood. That's also something ASME and lots of Alaska seafood processors and fishermen are counting on. The delegation will be in the U.S. through July 14th, making stops in Seattle and Anchorage, but the majority of their time was spent on Kodiak. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Trump administration has reopened a decades-long fight over whether tribes in Alaska can create sovereign areas known as Indian Country. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports.
When Native American tribes put land into trust with the federal government, it gives it special status. It's not subject to most local and state laws. It's not taxed either. These lands in the lower 48 are commonly known as Indian Country. And for decades, Alaska tribes weren't able to do this. The Department of Interior cited 1971's Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as the reason. That's a legislation that set up regional Native corporations. But most of Alaska's 200-plus tribal organizations weren't part of the deal.
We did not receive land from the federal government, so we're kind of at a loss to our Aboriginal land claims.
Ivan Ensalewski is executive director of the 900-member Nanilchik Traditional Council. About a year ago, it got a federal grant to run a public bus service on the Kenai Peninsula.
We do a static bus route, basically running from Nanilchik down to Homer and up to Soldotna and Kenai.
The tribe decided to put its bus garage into trust. That would exempt it from local and state taxes and potentially unlock further federal money.
It just simply made a lot of sense. This is a piece of property that would work well and could be well-suited for the land into trust application.
The tribe had reason to be optimistic. After more than a decade of litigation, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began accepting lands into trust applications from Alaska tribes in 2014. 3 years later, the Craig Tribal Association on Prince of Wales Island made history by becoming the first, and so far only, one to be successful. That was in January 2017. President Trump was inaugurated a week later. That meant new appointees running the Department of Interior and Bureau of Indian Affairs. And then, this June, tribes were notified the rule was being withdrawn, pending further review. Anchorage attorney Lloyd Miller helped sue the Department of Interior that eventually opened the way for Alaska tribes to put lands into trust. He's disappointed it didn't last.
The White House has made it clear that anything associated with President Obama is to be questioned and presumptively reversed. And the White House has taken that to heart. The agencies have taken it to heart. And this is certainly part of that directive.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs released a list of trust applications from tribes, but did not otherwise respond to requests for comment. It's unclear where Governor Bill Walker's administration stands. It has fallen in line with previous administrations in opposing Alaska tribes from establishing sovereign trust lands. Alaska Native leaders who advised Walker recently met over the federal government's sudden U-turn. Melissa Borton chairs the governor's Tribal Advisory Council. She said the feeling among the group is that when it comes to putting lands into trust, the so-called Alaska exception is unfair.
If tribes feel the need and see the importance in putting that land into trust, then they should have that opportunity just like every other tribe in the nation has. We should not be treated differently than the lower 48 tribes.
In the meantime, Alaska Native tribes have invested thousands of dollars in their applications. Ensalewski says for his tribe in Nanilchik, the outlook remains uncertain.
There's a long time that goes into these applications, and it's definitely frustrating to see something potentially hold that up right at the end.
That's not quite the end of the story. This month, the Bureau of Indian Affairs sent a letter to tribal leaders saying it would hold consultations with Alaska tribes and take public comment over the issue. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Bresnick.
A judge will decide whether a federal civil rights suit filed against the city of Fairbanks can proceed. The four Native men, known as the Fairbanks Four, say racially motivated police misconduct led to their wrongful convictions in a 1997 murder. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the civil suit is the latest development in an unresolved case that continues to haunt the community.
New evidence heard in 2015 pointed to alternative suspects in the 1997 beating death of Fairbanks teenager John Hartman, but exoneration of the Fairbanks Four, long jailed for the murder, hinged on a slow legal process, and the men opted to settle with the state and city. The agreement vacated the convictions of George Freeze, Kevin Pease, Eugene Vent, and Marvin Roberts, but also barred them from suing for damages, a stipulation they're now challenging in federal court. Fairbanks 4 attorney Mike Kramer says the men had little choice but to go along with the December 17, 2015 settlement.
This was an involuntary agreement thrust upon, three men who had been incarcerated for an excess of 72 years. wrongfully that wanted to get out for Christmas. And, of course, Marvin Roberts was out on parole, but the other three depended on him signing this agreement as well. It was an all or nothing.
Kramer says the Supreme Court only allows such agreements under strict guidelines.
And that is essentially whether the agreement was voluntary and, you know, whether it serves the public interest.
Kramer maintains the Fairbanks 4 release agreement does not serve the public interest, especially from the city's perspective.
If the city really believed that these guys were murderers, it's hard to imagine how public policy could be served to set murderers free, you know, in exchange for them agreeing to cover up official misconduct or, you know, not bring claims alleging official misconduct.
Kramer says the case is unique and that others challenging such agreements have involved lesser crimes. City attorneys have requested the case be dismissed. Their motion maintains the Fairbanks Four voluntarily agreed to the settlement, an agreement they're using to show they were wrongly convicted and at the same time challenging in court. City attorneys declined to comment or did not reply to requests for comment, but their motion says damage suits require an official finding of innocence, something the settlement does not provide. The Fairbanks 4 legal team filed a response to the city's motion to dismiss the case July 2nd. The city has until August 6th to reply, after which the judge can set up a time to hear arguments on the dismissal motion. The Hartman murder remains unsolved. No physical evidence has linked anyone to the crime, and none of the alternative suspects pointed to in the 2015 hearing have been charged. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what's a spruce tip cocktail taste like?
People come in from out of town and they're expecting a piney flavor, and it's actually more of a bubblegum sweetness.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Federal managers recently agreed to a special early opening of the fur seal harvest on a Bering Sea island. The decision came after a request by the tribal government on St. George. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Nat Herz reports tribal leaders say they needed the meat because the island store was running out of food.
Imagine you live on a remote island in the middle of the ocean. The weather's bad, flights have been canceled, and the store is starting to run out of fresh food. This is not the plot of a post-apocalyptic movie. It's real life on St. George Island in the Pribilofs. Pat Pletnikoff is the mayor.
I don't know how many times I've called Ace to say, hey, where are our groceries?
Ace is a cargo carrier that flies to St. George.
Why can't we get them? Why is it that we're not getting any freight service to St. George, and why aren't your airplanes flying out here?
Pletnikoff says about 60 people live on St. George. It's way out in the middle of the Bering Sea, more than 200 miles from the mainland. Passenger planes only come twice a week, and flights can be canceled by bad weather, which can make it hard for residents to keep fresh food around. One thing that's not in short supply on the island is meat. St. George and nearby St. Paul both host massive populations of fur seals in the summer and fall. Between them, about 500,000. But their harvest is strictly regulated by the Federal Fur Seal Act. When the St. George store was starting to run short on food recently, the island's tribal government presented the National Marine Fisheries Service with a request: open the subsistence seal harvest before the scheduled start date of June 23rd. The service responded by issuing a special temporary rule allowing the harvest to start 3 days early. Mike Williams works for the Fisheries Service.
The community needed food, and this was the way that the government could help with that.
Williams says typically no more than 150 seals are taken in a year. Each one has about 30 pounds of edible meat. Those numbers are way down from when the seals were hunted commercially for their fur. That's how St. George and St. Paul were originally settled 2 centuries ago. Russians forcibly moved Alaska natives from the Aleutian Islands to help with the harvest. Even after the U.S. bought Alaska from Russia, the government continued relying on Pribilof residents to hunt and process fur seals. But the hunt ended in the 1980s, and Pletnikoff, St. George's mayor, says his island hasn't received enough government support to transition to a more diverse economy. Pletnikoff says that without better, federally subsidized air service, St. George will continue to face problems like the food shortage that led to the early seal harvest.
This early start on fur sealing, while a good gesture on the part of the United States government and the tribe, doesn't begin to address the serious issues that we need to deal with and we need to get a handle on.
St. George faces continuing uncertainty about its flight schedule amid the bankruptcy of Penn Air, the passenger airline that serves the island. Residents are also trying to improve their boat harbor to allow better access for barges. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Nat Herz in Anchorage.
Residents of Haines can now buy marijuana legally in town. Winter Greens, the borough's first recreational marijuana dispensary, opened its doors to the public Tuesday afternoon. KHNS's Henry Leisha paid a visit to the shop and has this story.
When tourists arrive in Haines on a cruise ship, the first thing they see as they leave the boat are the local businesses facing the harbor along Beach Road. There are places to rent bikes, buy souvenirs, and book tickets for the fast ferry to Skagway. They can also see a storefront trimmed with green where marijuana is available for purchase to anyone over the age of 21.
Hi.
Hello.
Can I see your ID?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. Thank you. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I thought I was going to see a big scary guy here.
Come on in.
At the door, Shauna Adams checks IDs before customers enter the store. She and her husband, Jason Adams, moved to Haines to open the business. It has been a long process.
So I guess about 2016, I came up for the first time.
That's Jason.
My wife and I had grown and done a medical and commercial grow in Oregon, and we'd also helped with a dispensary and seen how that worked, and we decided we needed to look for a spot. So I flew out and started walking around the streets of Haines with a measuring wheel, figuring out where boundaries were for safety, because we have to be 500 feet from a school or a church. And so we found this shop and we decided this is it. We can do it here.
Jason says that initially there was some skepticism about setting up a pot shop in Haines.
I think the negativity that we got 2 years ago or 3 years ago when we started looking up here, there was a little bit of negativity and we were worried about it. I think other people bringing their businesses here were also worried about that. And then nothing ever came of it. The borough was 100% behind us. I feel like any kind of complaints we had were answered quickly.
Since then, the Adams have spent a long time making sure that everything is above board, from licensing regulations to fire marshal permits. Adams says he understands that the state needs to set up careful regulations when it comes to this business. And how do those regulations compare to Oregon?
Easier, but more strict. So I would say less steps, more direct. And so I felt like even though it took a year to get certain paperwork through, I believe that once they started, it went very fast. Like from the time they started on our turn to look at our paperwork, the state of Alaska, AMCO, really just stepped it up. They went very, very fast.
Ed Hess works at Winter Greens as well. He is a close friend of the Adams and worked on a growing operation in Brookings, Oregon. He says that while the cruise ships will bring in a lot of customers, so far they have seen a lot of locals.
Everybody says the same thing. We have been waiting, and we're so glad you're open. I think Looped Up Lumber is so happy that people won't be calling there every day to see if we're open. That's one thing that I did hear from somebody.
It is illegal to consume marijuana in public in Alaska. However, there has been discussion across the state about creating spaces where customers can smoke on site. Alaska's Marijuana Control Board will meet in August to discuss the issue. Jason says that he would like to be able to provide a separate space for consumption in the future.
I'm looking for a spot for on-site consumption, but you can't use it here. So it would be, you know, they'd have to leave and go off-site. And we're searching for that and then how that would work as a business plan. Because right now, liability-wise, it's very touchy and hard to figure out.
At the moment, Winter Greens is collecting data to figure out what their hours should be. However, Jason says they do plan to stay open in the winter. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, spruce tips. Each spring in southeast Alaska, the Sitka spruce tip harvest happens suddenly and only lasts about a week. With the flavor's growing popularity and short harvest season, Alaska businesses have come to rely on a small-town commercial operation to meet the growing demand. KTOO's Annie Bartholomew met the professional pickers who forage this plant each year.
On a blustery May afternoon, Molly Kelly and her family spread out along the tree line of Gustavus's sandy beaches. They're picking spruce tips, the bright green nubs that grow on the branches of Sitka spruce. The harvest has become an annual tradition in Gustavus that locals refer to as spruce tipping. With a bucket hung around her neck, Kelly and her sister Cassie Parker show us the proper technique.
You definitely want to have rubber gloves because your hands will get real torn up. Yeah, long sleeve to protect the arms that get poked.
And if you get in a really thick bush, you can just like slide your arm down the branch and just take as many spruce tips as you can, just like that.
Kelly grips the branch with a gloved hand and slowly drags down the limb, pulling away a handful of spruce tips. They say it can take anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes to collect a pound, depending on energy level and kid interruptions.
I have not picked many at all. I've only picked maybe 50 pounds.
I've got 75 pounds right now.
Their nephew Caleb, who is nowhere in sight, has already got close to 1,000 pounds.
He's around here somewhere.
I know.
The Gustavus spruce tipping season all started back in 2000 when the Alaskan Brewing Company approached Pep's Packing, a family-owned fish processing plant, to provide the spruce tips. The Juneau Brewery's inaugural order of 500 pounds eventually became their seasonal winter ale. An English old ale style, honoring the history of Captain James Cook, who brewed spruce beer on his voyages to prevent scurvy. Now the brewer uses Gustavus tips in their many spruce beers, including the Spruce IPA, which took home a gold award at the biannual World Beer Cup competition this spring. At Pep's Packing, families unload garbage bags full of spruce tips into special vacuum-sealing bags that owner Pep Scott weighs and records.
One of the families that has been picking for us since the very beginning now has three generations picking, and they kind of have this rivalry going where Grandpa tries to pick more than his son, and it's pretty neat. They'll be in here soon. So,
Pep and her husband, John Scott, says the money made by the picker stays in Gustavus, giving an economic boost to the town.
We've got little teeny kids all the way up to, I think, our oldest picker. He'll be here soon, and I believe he's 75. Five now. I think he could be older than that, but you know, I don't ask. So
another kid bought a lawnmower a couple years ago with his spruce tip money, and then he mowed lawns the rest of the summer.
Because of a cold spring, this year's spruce tipping season ran extra long, allowing that nephew Caleb to collect more than 3,000 pounds in 2 weeks. That's at this year's price of $3 a pound. The spruce tips are packed in 50-pound fish boxes. When they have enough to fulfill orders, Pep's Packing charters a Cessna aircraft to move the product across destinations in Southeast. Pep's largest customer is the Alaskan Brewing Company, but the spruce tips also go to smaller outfits like Copa Ice Cream in Juneau and as far as Rogue Ales in Oregon.
So the Spruce Tip Collins is made with a spruce tip simple syrup that we make in-house, fresh squeezed lemon, our gin, and topped with a bubbly water.
In Juneau, a Malga distillery owner, Maura Selenek, says they've relied on Pep's Packing to provide the spruce tips for their syrups, spruce tip soda, and small batch juniper gin that's distributed across the state. She says the spruce tip taste is indescribable until you've tried it.
People come in from out of town and they're expecting a piney flavor, and it's actually more of a bubblegum sweetness. A lot of times we'll have people come in and they'll say, you know, this gin tastes like Southeast Alaska or tastes like the rainforest.
The distillery could buy ingredients from growers in the lower 48, but for them, it's a source of pride knowing the product was hand-foraged by Alaskans, creating economic opportunity in rural communities, and not to mention, a taste of Southeast in every glass. For AK, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from No Attack Post in Juneau. During the summers, Post can be found playing the violin for tourists visiting the state's capital as they disembark from cruise ships.
I started playing the violin 11 or 12 years ago. I started when I was turning six-ish, I think. And I started at a bluegrass summer camp that was hosted here in Juneau by a band called Barefoot Bluegrass. I went to the summer camp with no musical experience in my family at all. And I came home after that first week and said, "Mom, Dad, I really want a violin. Please buy me a violin." And so they went to one of the band members and asked where we could get one, and they happened to have their old violin was sitting in their parents' attic, and they sold it to us. Whenever and wherever someone will hire me, I do weddings fairly often, and I just played like a birthday party a week ago, and I've done a couple family reunions. But weddings are fairly common. One of the songs that I can do with my looped violin is Pachelbel's Canon, which people love to have at their wedding. Violinists are a dime a dozen. It's great. I love that there's so many people playing music, but there's so many people, especially here in Juneau. Which I think it's great is the jam program that's in the elementary school is getting everyone to play an instrument. I didn't have that when I was in elementary school. I haven't played bluegrass in over a decade. It's crazy. I only went to that camp for a couple more years before they stopped coming to Juneau, after that I started taking private lessons with Mr. Shaw, who's one of the teachers in town, and since then I've been classically trained, and in the past few years have moved over to sort of modern and pop. I'm going to be a senior this year, so I got one more year in Juneau, I'll keep doing it as long as people will listen to me, and with the different group of people every day on the cruise ship, that's an easy thing to accomplish.
No Attack Post lives in Juneau. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Bartholomew, Jacob Steinberg, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Kodiak, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Nat Herz in Anchorage, and Henry Leisha in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Annie Feit. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.